Welcome to Witchlit, a place to talk about the craft of writing and writing the craft. I'm your host, Victoria Rashke, author, publisher, witch, and nosy Scorpio. Witchlit is brought to you by Thousand Bolt Press, a family-owned independent publisher established to produce the books we want to see in the world. Titles including Changing Paths by Yvonne Abreu, Conjuring the Commonplace by Lane Fuller and Corey Thomas Hutchison, and my latest book, Verona Green, can be purchased directly from thousandvoltpress.com or wherever you buy books. Brandon Weston is a healer, writer, and folklorist who owns and operates Ozark Healing Traditions, an online collective of articles, lectures, and workshops focusing on the Ozark Mountain region. As a practicing folk healer, his work with clients includes everything from spiritual cleanses to house blessings. He comes from a long line of Ozark Hill folk and works hard to keep traditions that he's collected alive and true for generations to come. He's also the author of Ozark Folk Magic, Plants, Prayers, and Healing, Ozark Mountain Spellbook, Folk Magic and Healing, and most recently, Granny Thornapple's Book of Charms, Magic and Folklore from the Ozark Mountains. Brandon Weston, welcome back to Witchlit.
Thanks for having me. Glad to be here.
It's so exciting to have you back on and talk about your new book, which is lovely. So our first question for everyone is usually why write? So you answered that question in a previous episode. Folks should go listen to. So why write this book? Because it feels a little different than the first two.
Yeah, it definitely is. I've been telling people that it's like an iceberg with Ozark folk healing traditions. And I feel like the first book is the sort of the tip of the iceberg, a lot of the history and the backstory. And then the spell book, you know, we get a little bit deeper into the ritual traditions and things like that. And with Granny Thornapple, we're like getting even deeper with this stuff. So Granny Thornapple, it focuses on the Ozark charming tradition, which includes all of the verbal charms and poems and nursery rhymes and prayers and all of that good stuff that makes up this sort of verbal healing and magical tradition here in the Ozarks. And so this is a tradition that typically is very secretive. A lot of it is, you know, verbal charms and prayers that are passed down word of mouth. A lot of these things come from the very complex and beautiful storytelling tradition in the Ozarks. And so why write this book? I think that I really wanted to give people a sort of a different perspective from the ritual work. I think a lot of times when we talk about folk magic, we talk about all of the stuff we can do, you know, the ingredients and the potions and, you know, all of this good stuff. And in the Ozarks, all of that stuff is, you know, a part of the tradition and is valid. But, you know, there's this other tradition too that doesn't really rely on a lot of outward ritual, but sort of connects to this inward poetic power or inward sort of magic inside of the charmer themselves. And it's a lot more in the moment reactionary magic, you know, the sort of, I give this example a lot. You're in a grocery store and you see your enemy across the aisle. What do? To protect yourself or to, you know, whatever it might be. And the charming tradition is really presenting an answer for that question of what do I do? The charming tradition offers these sort of in the moment reactionary techniques and this reactionary sort of magic. So I think, this is just sort of deepening the story a little bit.
Yeah. And just reading it, having read your first two books, I think it's not important that you have read the first two books. Like, you can enjoy this book without it, but
right,
I do think
exactly.
It does bring something to the book. And there are several places where you point out, you know, I'm going to tell you the important thing here, but I talk about this more in depth in a previous book, which I always appreciate. But I think one of the things I loved about this book the most, and maybe it's just the fiction writer in me, but I love the story of Granny Thornapple that you tell throughout the chapters of the book. Do you want to talk about that a little bit? Because now I want like the whole series of Granny Thornapple novels. Like
right.
if you need a project. So,
I mean, it's something I've definitely thought about because I sort of, in my writing anyway, I sort of started off in fiction writing short stories and folk stories and stuff like that. And so, you know, like the first two books, both are introduced by a folk tale. And with Granny Thornapple, because this charming tradition really is born out of that oral folk culture, that storytelling culture, I really, really wanted it to be folk story heavy. And part of the reason for that in the Ozarks, and this tradition unfortunately has slowly been dying out the less and less, you know, we rely upon oral storytelling, but, you know, used to everything was passed down by word of mouth, but not just by word of mouth, but by stories and by teaching stories. So even, you know, teaching somebody a recipe for a cake might involve a story. And there's this idea, especially the stories that sort of are meant to introduce healing techniques and magical techniques and things like that, stories that are even supposed to sort of awaken the gift within a person. There's this aspect that, you know, on the surface level, these stories are entertainment, but if you know, you know, and you might be able to, if you have the gift, or if you are sort of gifted in this way, you might be able to actually pick up things in the stories. And so I really wanted to not just create these stories for entertainment. Obviously, they are there for entertainment, but also, you know, to connect to that idea of the teaching story and, you know, what you can sort of glean out of these stories, what you can pick up out of these things. So.
Yeah. Yeah. It's just, you've created a whole world there. Like I want to sit in Granny Thornapple's shack, or I guess Graham Watson's cabin. Things change. As people who read the book, you'll see that the story evolves over a couple of generations. And, I don't know, it was just so lovely. And I was like, this is such a great way to kind of sink into this. And then, you know, like you said, each chapter is kind of a lesson to you, like about the charms that are there. And I don't know, reading some of the charms, it made me remember how much I loved nursery rhymes when I was a kid. Like we had this little like encyclopedia of nursery rhymes that was just like, I think it fell apart finally because I read it so much. And I'm like, maybe there was more to this than I thought.
I 100% agree with that. I've always loved nursery rhymes and fairy tales and things like that. And I think that, you know, today we kind of have, you know, these are children's things. And, you know, a lot of these nursery rhymes, the Mother Goose rhymes, originated as verbal charms and continued as verbal charms. And so I don't think that nursery rhymes get as much respect as they deserve for their sort of histories and what secrets are, you know, underneath the surface. Yeah, I'm a big collector of all Mother Goose books. I love them all. And so Granny Thornapple, it features a lot of nursery rhymes that you can use as verbal charms. And a lot of them I collected from individuals who used them as verbal charms. Mm-hmm. And so I've been telling people, you know, Granny Thornapple, this book is a starting point. And it's a place to sort of build a good foundation within this tradition and then be able to go out and discover your own verbal charms, collect your own charms, create your own charms. And of course, the Mother Goose rhymes. I mean, there's so many good ones that you can go out and you can repurpose and look deeper into. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, there's a lot of there's a good foundation here, but then there's a lot of sort of potential for people to be able to take this and really connect to it, which is, I mean, that's the point of all of this is to be able to sort of awaken something within yourself that may not be awake yet, and to be able to then use your own innate power and poetic power and create your own verbal charms, just like Granny Thornapple did.
Yeah, no, I do love that both the stories of Granny Thornapple and in several places in the, you know, talking about the charms themselves, you really say, you know, the ones that come to you kind of unbidden, those are the ones that are important. Those are like, those are powerful to do that. And I had this, like, I don't know if it's like the influence of 90s chaos magic or just like, you know, the weird places my brain goes, but I was like, oh gosh, the things that we remember, like jingles.
Yeah.
From commercials. And I was like, isn't that weird? Like how our brain is wired for rhyme to remember it that way in English, especially. But we kind of, like you said, we dismiss rhyming poetry. We dismiss nursery rhymes as kid stuff, but it just like earworms us. Like yeah. They just get in and stay. So I was like, huh, this is all very interesting.
Yeah. As a kid, I was definitely the kid that could recite every commercial jingle, you know, on the TV. And so I think that there's something very primal about that sort of like verbal, the memorization of it, the verbal aspect of it. I think that there's something that unfortunately we've lost in the sort of internet age. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, this tradition is really, it's about connecting to that. And, you know, I say in the book, it's not just about memorizing these charms, which that's a part of the tradition. You know, charmers have definitely, you know, prided themselves on their memorization abilities. And at one point, a sign of having the gift is being able to quickly remember things. So that's definitely an aspect of this. But I think personally, in our sort of modern world, what's more important is being able to connect to where these charms come from. And they really are born from that poetic inspiration that's in all of us, which at one point in all of our sort of collective ancient past was considered to be a mysterious divine gift. Like the gift of the poet was powerful. Mm-hmm. To be able to satirize, you know, I think about the role of the bard in Irish culture as a person who is quick-witted and able to you know, bend other people's words, and that just that verbal aspect in and of itself is power. And so that's sort of the heart of all of this, even more than just, you know, memorizing the charms and memorizing, you know, the limited motions, hand gestures, things like that, that might go along with some of the charms. More than that, it's about connecting, and it's about connecting to that sort of inner fire, that inner poetic mm-hmm. inspiration. Like I said, it's in all of us to connect to.
Yeah. I think last time we were on, we talked about like having access to like the academic work that's already been done, but mm-hmm. you've done a lot of this work on your own, just talking to people. I mean, you're kind of your own charm catcher. Do you want to talk about that? Like how you've approached that and like what that means for you, like personally?
Yeah. I, you know, in a lot of aspects of my work, I see myself as a sort of bridge between the traditional and the non-traditional. And so with the charming tradition is a perfect example of that. The charms that I've listed in Granny Thornapple are all of a classification of, you know, being able to be passed down through writing, or, you know, not just through spoken word, but, you know, this is just the, you know, a small portion of the amount of charms that I've collected. And so many of them can't be passed down through writing. They have to be passed down by word of mouth. They can only be passed down to certain numbers of people. And so this is a sort of Granny Thornapple is a really a sort of bridge between that traditional and the non-traditional. All of these charms are being presented and passed down in a very non-traditional way through the written word, but they still represent power. They still work, so to speak. And so, yeah, in my work traveling around, I've collected, like I said, charms that I probably won't be able to pass down. I've collected ones that I have passed down and those that I've sort of spread out through my written works. And as with a lot of things in the Ozarks, this sort of blending between the traditional and the non-traditional becomes a tradition of itself. So it's very, I always say it's very Ozark to work in that way. You know, a lot of the teachers that I've worked with, they'll pass down charms and say, oh, you can't pass this to anybody else. You have to keep this secret. But then at the same time, they'll, you know, write down a little verse or something and say, but this one you can pass down. You can give this to anybody you want. Mm-hmm. And so there's room for a lot of different sorts of, I guess, ways of connecting to the charming tradition. And for me, and sort of my travels and research and things like that, just the diversity of practices has been so surprising and so refreshing for me. And that's one of the things that I hope I've been able to get across with the books, is this idea that, you know, no matter how you pick up this stuff, no matter where it comes from, no matter how you found it, you can still take it and make it your own, and you can still evolve the practice, and you can make traditions yourself. Mm-hmm. We always think about these traditions as being sort of, I don't know, these static things of the past, these artifacts. And it's our responsibility to like clean up these artifacts and take care of them. But everyone forgets that all traditions had a beginning. They had a beginning point somewhere in the past. And so my role throughout all of this has always been sort of bringing forward the traditions that we can bring forward, but then leaving room for our own creative inspiration to create new traditions that we can pass on then. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I do think we have this idea that, you know, well, and it kind of has happened too, that, you know, once it's written down, it's kind of fossilized mm-hmm. in that form. And I mean, I see that like in occultism in general, is that we, you know, the older it is, the better, right? Like it's, that gives it some provenance and some gravitas if it's the oldest thing you can find written about this, blah, blah, blah.
All right.
And I'm like, well, who came up with it to start with?
Exactly.
Who did that the first time? So, I mean, I think about that just in terms of a lot of things, like just because I have, you know, kind of talking about like telling a story to tell you how to make a cake, like cookbooks are like that too. Like people have this idea, well, it's in the cookbook and I have to make it this way. And I'm like, somebody came up with that recipe. You know, it's not, this is all like from that, like you said, that divine spark of the bard or whatever. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that didn't go away just because somebody wrote it down once.
Exactly. And I think that, you know, to use the cooking metaphor, which I think cooking and magic really, I mean, the metaphors really work well together, but yeah. Just to use the cooking metaphor again, you know, like somebody had to have created that recipe, but you know, the bare bones is there as a good sort of foundation, as a mm-hmm. good structure for the recipe. But then, you know, the sort of details within that are free to evolve and to change. And, you know, sometimes you evolve and change something and it doesn't work out. And, you know, I've done that lots of times where, you know, I've inherited rituals and things like that, where I, you know, deviate from like what was passed to me in an effort to evolve it and it doesn't work, or, you know, something strange happens. And then you can kind of revisit, you can go back and say, okay, well, what about this didn't work? Mm-hmm. And so I think, you know, unlike a lot of folk magic traditions, the Ozark tradition is so flexible and so diverse and so varied, partially because, well, I think in a big part because, you know, all of these traditions originated with small family groups. And so it wasn't like you had one monumental sort of tradition that, you know, everybody would get together and do this one thing. No, you had small family groups that were often isolated, heavily isolated from one another, and they were evolving and picking up new things. And the amount of people that I've met in the Ozarks who have been influenced by dreams. So, you know, I've met charmers who received verses and poems and things in dreams, or in like visions and things like that. And so that to me is very exciting, because it leaves the door open for the tradition to evolve and to grow mm-hmm. and to change based upon the practitioner's connection to the actual practice. And so it isn't a rigid tradition. There is a lot of evolution mm-hmm. and things we can add our own flavor to.
Yeah. And I just think about like that idea, you know, I always feel like there's this tension about keeping traditions alive, about making sure that we keep this thing, but also like if it becomes a fossil, like if you have, I'm trying to think of, you know, a good example, but, you know, I was just saying, like, if you have a charm for like safe train travel, Arkansas, like Tennessee, doesn't really have train access. There's not right. a lot, like, you know, so like how, you know, if you just decide, well, I can't use that because it's about a train, mm-hmm. then that's lost, or it becomes a museum piece, right?
Yeah.
If you go, okay, well, I'm going to fly or I'm going to travel by car. So how do I update this charm or something? And to me, that's really more what keeping a tradition alive is about.
Yeah. Yeah. And the intention behind it, you mm-hmm. know, like, that reminds me, there's I've collected a few Ozark verbal charms that for traveling specifically, that the language of the charm involves horses. Even though the charmers that I collected it from said, you know, this is for if you're driving or on an airplane or, mm-hmm. you know, whatever it might be. And so the words sort of, and the images have this a little bit of this timeless sort of quality to them, but the intention behind it can change mm-hmm. as well. And so there's lots of verbal charms like that where, you know, you don't necessarily have to update every word of the charm, but again, connecting to your own sort of poetic power, you can change the intention behind mm-hmm. the charm that you're working.
Yeah. And I think one of the other things you point out several times is that so many of these are simple because they were nursery rhymes or they were mm-hmm. Mother Goose rhymes, or, you know, they're just like a quick phrase or maybe like a verse from the Bible that's short, that somehow that seems like it wouldn't have the same amount of power as like this elaborate, mm-hmm. like ceremonial ritual or something. And, you know, it's funny to me that that's kind of, I think, a truism. And a lot, again, like you said, it's like, what stuff do I need? You know, what is the timing? You know, all of this. And you talk about those and how they can be more powerful in this time, but sometimes you need it now. Like sometimes magic is like a la minute to go back to our cooking analogy. So.
Exactly. Yeah. Like, you know, I leave in my own practice, you know, I do like using the Farmer's Almanac and calculating the moon phase and the zodiac moon signs, which is, you know, a very traditional Ozark way of working. And I like doing that for people if I have the time. But, you know, it's very traditional, and to use that word again, in the Ozarks, to find healers and practitioners that can do both. That can formulate by the auspices, but then can also, you know, if a classic example of this is with the sort of old specialists. And so you don't really see them around anymore, but these were people like wart charmers, blood stoppers, burn doctors, that a lot of times had specific methods for very specific things that tended to be the quick ailments and like, you know, you cut off your finger while you're doing farm work, or you cut your leg, or you get a really bad burn. And so these are the things that people would have encountered that they needed, you know, quick first aid for. And so the specialists were there to be able to provide that. And they had very specific methods and very specific ways of countering or addressing those needs in the community. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of times, you know, as those needs have sort of fallen away in modern times, our needs kind of have changed a little bit. And so today, you know, it's being able to address curses and people, you know, sending the evil eye or, you know, whatever it might be, retribution work, things like that. Mm-hmm. But I think, there's definitely room for both the sort of ritualistic magic as well as the quick stuff. And I think that, at least in my own practice, is important to sort of foster both of those and to sort of know both of those areas. Mm-hmm. But that said, I've met charmers who just charmed. They didn't do any, you know, working with auspicious timing or anything like that. Their role was just to be the charmer and to be able to sort of work out things in the moment, which is definitely a talent.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. And I was thinking about one, well, I think it's important to also think about, like, you write about this and you're capturing these, but you are also a practitioner. You work as a healer in your community. So how does that translate for you? Like, how do you, balance those things in your own work?
Yeah. So, my own work, my own practice, looks a little bit different from, what I write about, because a lot of times what I'm writing about is the traditional stuff, in my own practice. And that's, like I said earlier, you know, the Ozark sort of practices, they're very diverse and there's a lot of room for people to sort of work in whatever way they want to work. And so in my own work, I love developing personalized rituals for people. And a lot of times that involves the use of verbal charms and things like that. But then it also involves a lot of magical timing. It involves a lot of sort of developing and marking on the calendar the exact time to do certain things to give the work the best chance possible. In my own work, I do find myself a lot of the times, you know, being out in the community and needing to use the verbal charms, a lot of which are the ones that are in this book. A lot of the ones that I use on a sort of daily basis for things come out in the book. Mm-hmm. So my own practice is a sort of a combination of a lot of different things. I like the diversity of it. I don't know what I'm going to get into on a daily basis. And I really like that.
Yeah.
And I think that that's sort of the heart of folk magic and folk healing in general is, you know, this is healing the folk. It's the magic of the folk, of the people. And so all of this stuff is meant to address the needs of the community, and the needs of the community are never set. You know, you never know what you're going to get into with the community. Mm-hmm. And so I think that a lot of times people put down folk magic for that aspect that, you know, it doesn't seem very, you know, like higher oriented, you know, like a lot of ceremonial magic is very sort of higher aspect oriented. You know, we're talking to angels and deities and all of this other stuff. And folk magic is just sort of like, oh, I don't know, this, you know, kid scraped their knee on the playground and I, you know, helped stop the blood with a prayer or whatever. Mm-hmm. And so
is
I think that there's...
It's not also talking to deities.
Right. Exactly. Exactly. It's in its own way. My practice, I think... You know, if somebody was to sort of observe what I do on a daily basis, they may not be very impressed because it's a lot of it is just, you know, talking. Mm-hmm. And that's sort of one of the beautiful aspects of the charming tradition is a lot of times it's not very showy, but there's a lot of power that is still under the surface of everything that's being done. Mm-hmm. So whether it's just reciting a prayer under your breath or, you know, telling somebody a story in order to sort of get them to think about something as a part of the healing process or whatever it might be, or whether you're just like sitting down at a table and chatting with somebody about their problems, you know, all of this is, you know, simple work, but it's very powerful work.
I was thinking just like, and I thought about this in reading the Granny Thornapple story in the book, and what you just said is that, you know, part of the magic of this like community folk magic is people have a safe place to land.
Yeah.
And that's something that a lot of us don't have. So So, I mean, that is creating kind of a beautiful space all by itself.
Yeah. And I think that that's a really important part of the healing process that's sort of been forgotten. You know, I've met old timers that still sort of, they have a presence within the community that is very traditional and very reminiscent of, you know, a very older time, much older time. But like in the Ozarks, you know, it was very traditional for healers to go and live with the families that, or the person that they were healing, while they were healing. And part of the reason for that is, yes, to observe symptoms and to be able to administer medicines, but it was also to be able to give them that safe place to land, like you said, being able to clean up the house and take care of the chores and take care of the kids, take care of a spouse, you know, putting food on the table or whatever it might be, to be able to give the person time to take for themselves and to take and to be able to engage with their own healing process. And that's a lot of what sort of community folk magic is there to do. Is it's not always very showy. It doesn't always involve a lot of ritual, but it's there to be able to allow people space to engage with their own healing process or engage with that, whatever situation it might be that they're trying to address in their life. And even the aspects of, you know, magical timing, engaging with the seasonal cycles and the moon cycles, this is all about setting aside time. It's all about taking time to focus and to, you know, get a little bit detail oriented or, you know, look beneath the surface. And so, yeah, it's this aspect that, you know, goes deep, but it goes deep into what I like to call sort of the ordinary magic, you know, daily life stuff, which for a lot of people doesn't seem very impressive, but to me is the magical stuff because it's what all of us have to deal with on a day-to-day basis.
Yeah. And I think just like, you know, building community at this point is kind of its own magic because we're all so siloed in our work, in our houses, you know, like very few of us have the good fortune to live in a village.
Yeah.
And maybe there's some downsides of that if everybody knowing your business, but you know, sometimes everybody knowing your business keeps you safe too. Like,
it's true.
You know, there's two sides to that coin. So. Yeah, I don't know. I think it's just really beautiful in that aspect of it. I really love. And maybe, you know, also there's a tiny part of me that also longs for that too. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, an idea of community and taking care of each other in that way. But one of the things I wanted to talk to you about, specifically about that, is since we last talked, you made all of your services no cost to your clients, your classes, all of that stuff. And just from your social media, I understand you got a little bit of pushback on that.
Yeah, it's really strange. You know, I think that anybody listening, and you've probably experienced this, anybody that's in the sort of folk magic community or offers any services, tarot readings, whatever it might be, you know, there's been this age old debate, and it's not a new debate. We think that all of these things are like new, but they've been happening since like the Middle Ages. People were arguing about this sort of stuff, about if we should charge for our magical and healing services. And it's such a thing that like people go back and forth about. And even in myself, I've gone back and forth about. And, you know, there's different perspectives. There's obviously like the traditional Ozark perspective is that you never take money for this stuff because it's considered to be a gift and you can't charge people for something you don't own. You know, you can't rent somebody else's property to somebody, you know. Yeah. And so that's like the very traditional view of it. But even within that, there are nuances. Because healers in the Ozarks definitely have taken gifts and food and money and have bartered and things like that. I've met several old time healers who worked in that old way. One healer I met refused to take money, but would leave her Bible open on the kitchen table. And it was kind of expected that you put money in the Bible so that later she would just find it So it wasn't like she was taking money. You were just sort of offering a donation without her knowing about it, that sort of thing. And so, yeah, I've gone back and forth with people personally. You know, I don't, if you charge for services, I actually don't care. I think everybody has the opportunity to sort of engage with their practice how they want to engage with it. And I think it's really important that if you are offering services, that you at least think about how you want to engage with the monetary process, how much you actually need from that versus maybe, you know, I don't necessarily need this money, so maybe I can offer things for a little bit less, that sort of thing. And so for me, I would rather engage with people who need services without dealing with money at all. But the door is always open for people if they feel like as a part of the healing process that it's important for them to give something, which definitely comes up. People feel like, you know, a sacrifice is a part of this process.
Yeah.
But that can take lots of different forms. So sometimes people will bring me food and I'm really appreciative of that. Or, you know, they'll buy me a cup of coffee somewhere or, you know, things like that. Or they'll help. I've had several people help buy supplies that I use in the practice. So they'll buy some, like, you know, incense and things like that, that I like to use. Mm-hmm. And so I think that, you know, from my perspective, from sort of an Ozark perspective, it's really important for each individual to think about and to engage with that exchange in their own practice. And I don't really agree with the sort of painting with a big wide brush over all of these traditions, which I think a lot of people try to do sometimes. Because experience has told me that you can say that all practitioners did it this one way, but that's just not true.
Yeah.
People have done things in lots of different ways. And so for me, this is a way for me to engage with my own practice in maybe a little bit deeper way. But it's certainly not something that I expect everyone to do.
Mm-hmm.
I'm lucky I have a full-time job on top of my full-time job.
Right.
So I don't necessarily need that sort of exchange.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I wonder like some of the pushback was from folks who, you know, either this is their livelihood and they do need to charge, or are like that somehow you deciding that that was not how you wanted to work was a judgment on people who did charge, which is always funny to me because, you know, what is it? The hit dog's going to holler kind of thing. It's right. Like, it wasn't about you. It wasn't about you. So.
Yeah. And I didn't make any judgments or anything in my announcements. It was just, you know, this is the way that I want to do this. And so this is the way that I'm going to do it. But I think that, yeah, there was some pushback, and I think of a lot of it was projecting, you know, people's own insecurities about it. There was also this weird aspect, and I don't know where this came from. I think it must be a modern thing, but this idea that if you don't charge for something, it must be worth less.
Yes.
So if you don't charge for something, there's a reason. You obviously don't know what you're doing, so you don't want to charge for what you're doing. And I don't know where that came from. I kind of encountered a few people who were saying things like that. And in the back of my mind, I was like, wait, what in capitalistic hell is this? Like,
I was going to say it's capitalism, but yeah,
it's absolutely that. And so I think, yeah, a lot of it is people with very good intentions who I think are maybe a little insecure in their own practice and kind of wanting to paint with that big brush. But then I think a lot of it is, you know, maybe people really wanting to justify charging what they're charging for their services.
Yeah.
And that's one area that, you know, I'm not going to judge anybody for, you know, however they want to do their practice or whatever. But I think that there are a lot of people out there that are price gouging, that are just, mm-hmm. you know, taking advantage of people. And I think that we all kind of know that's a part of the community, and has been for a very long time. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, me not charging for my services isn't necessarily a commentary on anything other than this is how I want to do my practice. And I encourage everybody to sort of engage with their own practice how they want to engage with it. And also, you know, for a long time, I was really afraid that if I didn't charge something, people would judge my practice. They would say, you know, well, your practice isn't worth anything because you're not charging for it. And so I really encourage people, as you're sort of engaging with that, to not be afraid to, you know, engage with your practice however you want to. I think I say this in Granny Thornapple, but, you know, there's also this aspect of, you know, if you don't want to do any of this work for anybody other than yourself and your family, that's okay too. Mm-hmm. You get to choose how you want to engage with your practice. If you don't feel comfortable engaging with the community in that way, that's fine. Mm-hmm. Community means lots of different things. Sometimes you're a community of one, you know, yeah. Sometimes you're a community of you and, you know, your partner, your kids, things like that. And then sometimes, yeah, your community is a little bit wider. But don't let those fears get in the way mm-hmm. of engaging with the practice, because it's still powerful to engage with, even if you aren't planning on helping or working with anybody, you know. I think that, you know, maybe this is my own opinion, but I think that there's definitely a lot of people out there that probably shouldn't be working for the wider community, and maybe should just be working for themselves and their families. Mm-hmm. So don't rush into any practice in the wider world. Healing yourself is enough sometimes.
Yeah.
And even that can be, you know, even that can be a healing act for the world around mm-hmm. you.
Yeah. And I do think about this aspect of, like, you know, social media culture around the occult and different practices. And it's like, you pick up a book on witchcraft and the next day you start an Instagram and you're selling your work, you know, and I'm like, yeah, I agree with you. And I think, you know, again, I don't want to be judgmental about it, but I'm also at the same time, I'm like, I worry about that person as much as I worry about the people they interact with.
Yeah.
Like, what is that? If you weren't really prepared, like, I don't know that, you know, yes, people should seek the help of licensed professionals for some things, but they don't always. Sometimes they show up at your doorstep first.
Yeah.
And that's a burden to take on. And, you know, that can put you in scary situations. So,
yeah, no, and I've definitely been in those situations before. I mean, I've been doing this long enough now where, you know, in the beginning, I would kind of take anybody that came to my door and would try to help them in any way. But now, you know, I will see and talk to anybody that contacts me, but, you know, if it's anything to do with physical health problems, mental health problems, things like that, I always tell people, look, what I do, I offer spiritual healing services to sort of provide the other part of the healing process, healing both body and the spiritual aspect of that. But I have no qualms sending people to address the physical side first, because mm-hmm. that's not what I do. I'm not a licensed medical professional.
You're not going to set their broken femur.
No, that's just not what I do.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, in the old days, healers had to do all of it because there was literally no one else around to do it. So, yeah, you had to be able to set a broken bone as well as, you know, remove a curse from someone at the same time.
Yeah.
But we live in a very different world. And even, you know, I've met a ton of healers, not just from the Ozarks, but, you know, there seems to be this evolution amongst folk healers that, you know, modern medicine is at this point where, you know, we can kind of turn to that to address the physical needs, but we can still have a place at the table. Mm-hmm. As folk healers, we can still offer something that maybe the modern medical field can't offer. So I think it's much more, we need a much more integrated system than the separated system.
Yeah.
But unfortunately, you know, all of that, we modern medicine, that's a whole podcast in and of itself. Yeah.
Well, I mean, I always joke about like, apparently like in modern Western medicine, your eyeballs and your teeth aren't connected to the rest of your body.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah, they're just sort of islands hanging out there. There's there's no connection to anything else, right?
Yeah, because we got to have separate insurance and blah, blah, blah.
Yep.
I'm like, yeah, this is crazy. But I also, while you were talking, I had this image of like you having to build a chicken coop because people would just bring you chickens.
Yeah, right. I haven't had that yet. I think people understand, you know, the sort of modern barter system.
Yeah, bring me the eggs, but don't bring me the chicken.
I did have, I had a lady who kept chickens and she gave me eggs on a regular basis. And that I was perfectly okay
with. Yeah, no, that's great. Yeah. Yeah.
I was like, bring me a dozen eggs and we're good.
Yeah, and I was thinking too, like in this kind of like larger conversation about like, dealing with, you know, the financial aspects of this mm-hmm. world, like yes, you are offering your services in this more traditional way, either, you know, what people can do or you know, barter or whatever, but also like you're still selling books. It's not like Llewellyn's just giving your books away on the street corner.
Yeah. I definitely still selling the books and happy to be selling the books. That, I mean, when the first book came out, I got some criticism about, you know, so like, you know, selling these traditions and things mm-hmm. like that. And I think in every book in the introduction, I have said multiple times that the information that is present within these books is a small sample of what is out there. And this small sample is a sample that comes from my own practice and comes from the healers that I have worked with, and all of it, we are all in this system okay with sharing this information. Mm-hmm. And so if there's any question about sort of exploitation or anything like that, no, all of this information was, you know, is freely available for me to give out to whoever I want to give out. And a lot of this comes from my own engagement with the practice itself. So, it's not like I'm selling granny's secrets or anything like that.
Yeah.
And I always tell people too, that like as much stuff is present in these books, there's 10 times as much that I will never publish, that mm-hmm. I will never sell, that I might pass down to limited number of people. And that's the way that people have worked for, you know, mm-hmm. centuries. Yeah. There are some things you can freely give. There are some things you can't.
Well, and I think, you know, I made the kind of joke about being a charm catcher earlier, but I do think about like this work, especially around folk magic and like regional folk magic, like these books, your books, other folks' books who've collected these kind of things, like it does preserve it in a system where these things fade. And memory, you know, people die and they don't share it or, you know, so it does give us like a window into those practices that might otherwise be lost. So I think it has value in that, like, you know, like the song catchers of the WPA mm-hmm. and all that, like, you know, yes, they were kind of crystallizing these versions of songs and stuff, but they might have been lost forever had they not done that work. And I think about your work that way too.
Yeah. Yeah. And the way that I've always approached my books is that these books are foundational. They're not the end all be all. All of these three of these books, and you know, anything that I write in the future, will always be the philosophy that I have, is that this is a place where you can build from. Mm-hmm. This isn't and you know, if you want to just make this your practice, that's okay. But everybody has the sort of opportunity to take this as a foundation and to work from it and to evolve it and to build it and to make it their own. And so I think with a lot of other systems, it's sort of prepackaged. you know, this idea that what you are getting is a complete something. And I'm fully willing to admit that what you're getting with my stuff isn't complete, because there's no end to it. Mm-hmm. That it's, you know, this is the foundation, and you're meant to take it and engage with it, however, you know, ad infinitum, you know, like however long you want to do that into the future. And that for me is exciting, because it's not just a museum display. It's a living tradition. Mm-hmm. And so because it's a living tradition, you can build upon it or not, however you choose to engage with it.
Yeah. And I think about, because you talk about, like, you use the term neo-traditionalist in the mm-hmm. book. And I really like that idea, because I think it also addresses this very modern thing that we have, is that, you know, like, every week on the show, I have someone who practices a different kind of magic. Mm-hmm. And I've read their book, and I know that it's influencing my work, because mm-hmm. I'm picking up these pieces. And I think that's true for a lot of us, unless you work in a very regimented tradition, is that, you know, it is impossible to have contact with all of these things and not absorb some of it. Or even if it is only how you think about a thing, mm-hmm. if it's not how you do it, if it's how you think about it, you're still changing because of that contact. So I love that idea of neo-traditionalism, of saying, yes, it is based in this thing, but it continues to grow and change and evolve.
Yeah. And the irony of, you know, introducing the sort of neo-traditional term is that sort of absorption of other things isn't new. That is the tradition. That is mm-hmm. traditional.
Right.
But today we have such, you know, we have a lot of baggage surrounding tradition that, you know, when I initially was thinking about how I wanted to present these things, I knew that if I just presented this stuff as traditional, people wouldn't believe it. They would say, oh, well, no, people in the past never evolved their practice. They were never influenced by dreams and by spirits yelling out of trees in the woods. And so, yeah, I know, right? And so I sort of developed that idea of the neo-traditional being based in the sort of capital T tradition, but then understanding that tradition evolves, and so we bring in other things into mm-hmm. the tradition. But really, you know, I have met so many very conservative, very capital T traditional healers in the Ozarks who, when introduced with a new verbal charm or a new prayer or a new Bible verse that they hadn't really thought about, were so willing to absorb that into their practice and so quickly absorb it into their mm-hmm. practice. And so this stuff that we're talking about isn't new. This isn't something that we're developing. It's something that healers and traditional folk practitioners and all of these people, it's what they've been doing so long. But we have such a disconnect with those traditional processes that we think they were just, you know, I guess, mimicking or mm-hmm. memorizing things, or, you know, a part of that sort of museum exhibit view of the past.
Right.
But in reality, you know, the neo-traditional is the traditional.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, it's a feature of practical magic that if it works, it works. It doesn't matter. If it works, it works.
Absolutely.
Do it. So yeah, no, I think that's, I don't know, it's just fascinating. And I am entirely sure I could talk about this for another hour with you, but in the interest of keeping our podcast somewhat digestible, I do want to give you an opportunity to talk about what's coming up next. Now the book is out and you have ongoing stuff. This will come out in early June. Okay. And then we'll do our little game of chance at the end.
Cool. So yeah, coming up, I'm doing book signings. I'm planning on continuing all of the events and readings and book signings through the year. So you know, I'm sure I have something coming up here soon. but I post everything on my website, ozarkhealing.com, and so there's an events page there that people can look at And like we were talking about earlier, I've opened up my archive of class recordings, and they're all free to download on the website. So if people are interested in smaller topics under the heading of, you know, Ozark Folk Magic, so classes about ghosts and fairies and curses and the almanac and using the Bible and magic, you know, there's classes for all sorts of stuff on the website. But yeah, I'm just really looking forward to being able to engage with people with Granny Thornapple. You know, the people that I've talked to that have read it have been as excited about it as I have been excited about it. And so that's been very, very nice to see. Mm-hmm. I like when people, they're enjoying the same things about it that I've enjoyed, which is very, very good for me as an author.
Yeah. And if you just happen to decide to write Granny Thornapple novels, take my money, literally.
Absolutely.
No. Because that's the kind of stuff I love to read. So do you happen to have a class on the house chickens? Because I'm now fascinated with house chickens.
No, I don't. I need to do. So I've done several like land spirits and house spirit classes, but I haven't talked about the house chickens in any of them. I need to do another class, just, you know, bringing in some new aspects. Yeah.
Go read Granny Thornapple's books, people, and learn about the house chicken. It's very, very important knowledge, I think. Great. All right. So we're going to do your game of chance. And I, because you've been on the show before, I did this time. I've had a couple other people on recently who were on before, and I did not do this. So I went and checked to see what you got last time, and you got politics. So we're going to cross that one off so you get a different question.
Awesome.
Well, let's see. So for those who this may be their first episode, I'm going to roll a die and Brandon will get a question about death, sex, religion, politics, or money, but not politics because we're changing it up. And if I roll a six, you get to pick, but you can't pick politics. Oh, four, of course. So we'll do it again. Oh, six. So you get to pick.
Ooh, what were the categories?
Death, sex, religion, not politics, money.
Ooh, well, I feel like we already did the money. Mm-hmm. I feel like we already addressed that one. I mean, you know, death is always an interesting subject.
Okay. And this does come up in the book a little bit. But I wanted, because this was your third book, and I felt like I, just having read the other two books, like, I really just feel like you've grown as a writer in this book. Like, it's just, like, I hear so much more of your voice in this book than in the first two. So I kind of wanted to ask this question. And it's a big question. So what do you think the great work of your life is or will be?
Wow. Yeah, that's a big one. You know, so for as long as I've been engaging with this type of work, either writing about it or collecting it or practitioner, all of this, I've always viewed myself as being, okay, and this is going to seem very grandiose, but a sort of like John the Baptist figure, in that I feel like my life's work isn't to make this tradition, to blow up this tradition, you know, my life work isn't to, like, you know, be talking about the Ozarks on Good Morning America, you know, that sort of thing. That's not me. I enjoy doing interviews and stuff like that, but I'm not a people person necessarily. And so I'm the hermit. I'm definitely like the recluse in the woods. And I like that. I like being that. And I like engaging with my clients one-on-one, things like that. So I've always seen my work as being sort of revitalizing this tradition and, you know, bringing this tradition out to dispel some stereotypes about my culture and the place that I come from. And also to get people reinterested in it, reinterested in their own culture and where they come from and their family. You know, I would say most of the people that have read and engaged with my books had no idea that there was a culture here. They had the same experience that I had discovering this culture, which was like, whoa, what do you mean that this stuff is around here? Yeah. And so I definitely see my role as sort of laying that foundation out and sort of revitalizing this so that very sincere, very honest people can later on take this and run with it. And so whether or not that happens within my lifetime, I don't know. But I definitely think that my role is to just to get people engaged with their own spirituality and their own healing process, however that might look. Healing doesn't just include ailments, but it includes all of the situations in our life that we might come up against. So money stuff is a part of healing, love stuff and relationship stuff. So getting people to engage in their healing process in a way that is comfortable for them and culturally meaningful for them. And, you know, getting people reinterested in looking at tradition in maybe a little bit different way. Mm-hmm. So I hope that, you know, at some point in my life, you know, I will see a lot of people writing about this and interested and practicing it and teaching it and all of this other stuff. But yeah, I've always kind of seen myself as sort of laying that foundation, opening the door for people to come.
Oh, I love that. That's beautiful. And I don't think it's grandiose to say John the Baptist. I think analogies work. People will understand what that means. So.
I think grandiose might have been like, I'm the Jesus of this practice. Maybe that's a little bit much. But John the Baptist, that's maybe a little bit okay. Yeah.
No,
but like the forerunner, like, you mm-hmm. know, I'm laying the foundation for those to come. And I think one of the reasons why I have sort of identified with this is like I'm willing to recognize that even as a millennial, the technology has surpassed me, has, mm-hmm. you know, blown me by. Like there's so much about technology that I don't understand now. And so I think that for me, I'm really happy being able to teach and guide people and lay down that foundation. And then people who are able to better work within the sort of modern world are going to take this because, you know, these practices evolve, and at some point, these practices are going to need to address community problems that, honestly, today we haven't even been able to conceive of. Mm-hmm. You know, there are problems of the future that we aren't able to foresee today.
Yeah.
And so being able to lay down that foundation, it makes me feel good that there have been so many people interested in it, because I know that those people later on, the sort of younger generations that are really into this stuff, they're going to be addressing those community needs in a very good way. And that makes me really happy.
Yeah. I don't think AI is going to steal your job, though. I think you're safe.
I don't think so, unless AI starts like writing Granny Thornapple stories. But I don't know. I don't think that they'd be able to get the Ozark dialect correct, though.
I don't think so. And you know, AI does start writing Granny Thornapple stories, it's probably out and out theft. So,
right.
you got a case there. Yeah, I love that. And I just always enjoy talking to you, Brandon. Thank you so much for your time and for coming on the show again.
Thank you.
And writing this beautiful book that I hope people will pick up.
Thank you. Yeah, I'm glad you enjoy it. And it's always glad to be on the show.
Witch Lit is a production of Thousand Volt Press and is edited by Julian Rashke. Our intro music is Cosmic Glow by Andrew Kay, and our outro music is Voices by Alexander Shenankar. Transcripts and all our previous episodes are available at witchlitpod.com, and you can follow us on Instagram and Threads at witchlitpod. Please help other witches find us by leaving a rating or review wherever you listen to podcasts. Thank you for listening to and reading Witchlit.